Now, as you arrived at church this morning, oh, if I can have the PowerPoint, yeah, thank you. And or perhaps for a passerby during the week, may have seen the sign outside that this was the title of the sermon, and may have glanced at it and said, "Well, what's a good job?" And but a little careful observation would have seen that the message is based on the passage that we just read, and that's the book in the Bible called Job. And indeed, this message is based on this chapter. And so the title was really my little play on words, partly for my own amusement, but also, so just to clear up any ambiguity or confusion, it is a good Job. So rhymes with robe, okay? So that's a good Job. Anyway, now this particular chapter looks very closely at Job's life. And we can see indeed that it was a good life. So what I want to think about this morning is, what does holiness look like in a person's life? And perhaps for a more modern word, perhaps holiness, we mean purity and goodness, things that are right and true and pure. So what does holiness look like in a person's life? Now, we might have some immediate thoughts about that. We might think things like, well, it means self-control or obedience or try not to give in to temptation. In other words, aspects of life which sometimes we can find quite challenging. And we might feel that it's really largely down to our efforts, how well we do. And if you're anything like me, you might have a self-awareness that, or feeling that you often fall very short of what a holy life really should be. Is it really only reserved for some very special Christians or the pastor, perhaps? Now, perhaps as a summary, our overriding thoughts about a holy life might look something like this. That it's an understanding that God is totally holy and pure. There's no darkness or wrong or evil in him at all. He's totally pure and holy. And that a holy life is about our life and our behaviour coming into line with his standards and precepts. And that is indeed correct and true. But I don't think it's quite the full picture. So just keep that thought. And to illustrate this, when I was at school, occasionally there would be a school trip. And what would be happening is they'd be hiring a coach, there'd be a really special destination, and the bits we really liked was there'd be no school uniform needed and no classes at all. Okay, completely free day. And as soon as we got home that night, we might forget to clean our shoes and we might forget to do our homework, but we didn't forget to say to Mum or Dad, "Can I please go on the school trip?" Anyway, when the day came, I'm sure all of us, many of us experienced this, you get on the coach and sit down, and then the teacher gets on and stands at the front of the coach, looks down the coach and speaks to you, and they say something like this. "Now, if you all behave and follow our instructions and be where we ask you to be, not wander off alone, we will all be safe and happy, and we'll have a great day out." Okay, you ever had that experience? Yeah, so. But as I'm sure you have experienced also, there were always some who decided that they weren't going to obey. And that sort of sense of freedom, of being free of their uniform, of being free of the routine and of their classes, sort of got the better of them. And they were going to do just what they wanted to do. In other words, they felt that they would have a better time if they did it their way. And of course, what would happen is the teachers would then have to manage all those problems they created, not being at the right place on time, and then a delay getting to the next good thing, and so on. So their rebellion spoiled the day for the whole class. Okay, and they made it hard, a hard day for the teachers. Now, isn't that a picture of humanity and man's relationship with God? Rather than follow the one in charge, the one in authority, the one who does actually know the best way for us, man has decided that they know better and that there is more satisfaction from doing it their way. So then we have the world that we live in, don't we? At a big scale, there's wars and conflicts, and perhaps in our own society, nearer to home, we've got broken families, broken relationships, we've got people ill-treated, marginalized, there's hatred, cheating, oppression, unfairness, all these sort of dark characteristics of life for people who have forgotten their creator. And if we take that allegory of the school trip a little further, the teachers get to a place when it's so bad, they regret even trying. They haven't had the pleasure from taking the pupils out. And the next day back at school is just punishment and misery. Maybe playtime is cancelled. And certainly, they say, there won't be a school trip next year. I think one of the most tragic texts in the Bible is early in the Bible. It's Genesis 6:6. I'm going to put this on the screen. This is the verse before. So the Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. And verse 6 is the next bit. The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. You ever notice that second bit? His heart was deeply troubled. What insight does that give us into what God is like? His heart was deeply troubled. So that's... Now, to take the illustration even further, if the class is so badly behaved, sometimes these things just spread and the whole group gets unruly. The teacher can tell the coach driver, turn around, don't go to the special destination, and get us back in time for double maths. Now, the teacher has the authority to do that, and the children, rather than enjoying the generosity of the teachers, they then experience the discipline of the teachers. Now, there was an occasion when God's class, if I can put it that way, were released from something far worse than school. In fact, it was slavery in a foreign land. And they were on their way to a very special destination the Bible describes as being the promised land. But they were so badly behaved on the journey, they didn't actually get there. The one in authority who had planned that trip cancelled it. And the Bible also speaks in terms of an ultimate destination for all people, and that all will come to discover the Lord as either judge or as sort of father and saviour. So in all this, I'm going to try and put a very simple picture of why holiness matters. And by the way, that's probably a good question to ponder over sometimes, perhaps yourself or with others. Why does holiness matter? Why does it matter? Well, here's the picture. So we start with this holy and perfect God. And this graph will go on. But before we do, I thought I'd pick out a verse which describes God as being holy and perfect. And it's this. And I could have picked many. It's from Exodus. Who among the gods is like you, Lord? Who is like you? Majestic in holiness, awesome in glory, working wonders. I wonder whether it might be a good thing to read that together. But when you read it as if you're offering worship to God. Don't just read it like you're reading a timetable. Read it like you're offering worship to God. So perhaps read it together, shall we? So who among the gods is like you, Lord? Who is like you? Majestic in holiness, awesome in glory, working wonders. Good to express praise to God, isn't it? So we'll get back to our chart. So we start with the holy, perfect God. And he issues instructions, always has issued instructions to his people, how we're to live. And there's two responses. If the people obey God, it is true, as I said earlier, that it's about our lives coming into line with him. And then obedience to God's instructions honours God, but it also benefits humanity. Okay, so it's not just obedience for obedience' sake, if you see what I mean. It means that we also then live in harmony as people. If we disobey God, firstly, yes, it displeases and dishonours God, but secondly, it spoils humanity, it harms us. So to put this in my attempt at a simple sort of cycle, this is what I think it should be like. You start with a holy, perfect God. He gives his instructions. People follow and obey. And this is the thing. It's not just about following rules. It means that as they do that, they actually reflect the image of God in our lives, and we live harmoniously together. And I've got another verse here which describes what that means when we follow, when as a people we follow God. You are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. And that delights God. And I put the royal priesthood in bold because we end up actually administering the nature of God to each other and God's grace and love to each other. So that in turn delights God, and he continues to give instructions. We follow and obey, and that's how it should be. And you know, although all this starts with recognizing with a proper fear and honor of God, the people are so come to a place where they actually regard him as a good father. So it ends up being a relationship, a real relationship. So let's come to our passage, and firstly to introduce Job. Now, we're deep into the book of Job in chapter 31, but he's introduced right at the beginning of the book, and I'll just read this to you. It says, "In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God, and he shunned evil." So that gives us introduction to what Job was like. And then chapter 31, which I've picked out for this morning, shows us just how that holy and blameless life played out in his behavior. And I trust that we can learn something from his great example. Now, to break this down into some manageable themes, in recent months in CBC here, we were followed a series on the Sermon on the Mount. And this chapter of 31 of Job, this Job was written thousands of years before Jesus visited the world. And in many ways, it mirrors the Sermon on the Mount. There's many observations of this, and here's just a very brief summary of some of the themes. So the Sermon on the Mount is in Matthew 5-7. I've listed the themes there, and they're all in Job 31. So firstly, we've got lust and adultery. That's detailed in 1-9 and 12. Loving your neighbour, that's verses 13-15. Social justice, 16-23. Love of money and idolatry. So it mirrors very much the themes in the Sermon on the Mount, but was written thousands of years before Jesus arrived on the earth and brought that message. Now, I'm sure you would agree that these areas, if they're in right order, would reflect what makes up a pure and holy life. So hopefully looking at Job's life today will remind us of the Sermon on the Mount and bring it to life to us in a fresh way. So let's start by looking at these themes in Job's life. Now, Job begins by explaining that he was morally pure, that he did not look upon a woman in impure or inappropriate ways. Now, perhaps it's most significant that in this chapter describing his righteous life, he began by noting that he guarded his eyes from lust. Okay. Now, I appreciate this is a mixed congregation, and I only know what it's like to be a man. But I'm sure that for many, or even most men, this is an area we may feel has been a hard one to conquer, one that we perhaps fall at the first hurdle. And, you know, our culture is so proliferated with a so-called sort of liberation around attraction and relationships and how to conduct them. Our media industry and advertising subject us to imagery and ideas, which are very counter to God's design of holy living and what his design is for right human relationships. Now, in Job's time, it was actually considered culturally acceptable for the rich and powerful, which Job was. It was culturally acceptable for the rich and powerful to seduce a young woman and then decide to take her as another wife or as a concubine. Now, we might sort of gasp at that and think, how could that possibly have been? But consider what might be culturally acceptable today in these terms, in terms of what we think relationships are like, the sort of things we see in stories and films and so on, and in the media. But you know, Job wasn't conditioned by the culture of the time, but he was conditioned by the Lord's precepts. Now, I mentioned that this chapter mirrors the New Testament Sermon on the Mount, the teaching from Jesus. And I've heard it said for many years, and I've said it many times myself, even from the pulpit, that when Jesus came to the world, he brought a new and a higher standard of holiness. And it's based on this. I'm sure you've heard this. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I tell you, anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. But I read this passage a few weeks ago, and it's one reason I wanted to speak on it this morning. Since reading this passage for myself, I'm now in the mind that it wasn't some new super standard from Jesus, okay? It wasn't. God is not more holy now. And there are many times in the Old Testament when we see that it explains that God does look at the heart, not just at the outward appearance. So I don't think it is something that's a new standard. So again, it shows how they mirror each other. Now, I think Job's discipline in this area is a real important indicator of his general righteousness and his blameless behaviour. If a man can master this aspect of his life, it likely follows that his own personal self-control will be in good check in other areas. Okay. Now, verses 9 to 11, and I'm not going to do every theme in here, but I'm picking out a few. So verses 9 to 11 move on to another essential theme, and that is of adultery. Now, I did look up, just as a sort of a guide of statistics, of the percentage of adultery in marriages just in the UK, and it's roughly about 20%. But where I read it said, well, that's the ones that admitted to it, roughly about 20%. So that's the sort of order of adultery in our society. And I remember many years ago, I was driving and I was listening to the radio, and they were interviewing a man who started another online dating agency, but specifically for married people. So the interviewer said to him, surely what you're doing here is encouraging a culture of unfaithfulness and of adultery. He said, not at all. He said, a good majority of people who use dating sites now are married. So that's a lovely, cosy advert. It's a nice couple of decent single people and they meet these apps. That's not the story at all. This is what our society is like. This is what's culturally acceptable. And yet, you know, adultery is one of the most offensive things, sins against God, because it's unfaithfulness. And there's a very severe words in 1 Corinthians. It lists some that won't inherit the kingdom of God, and one is adulterers. It says adulterers will not inherit the kingdom of God. So it's a serious thing. And when you take it in the light of that message in Jesus' words, it's something serious to consider. Now, the Lord's design for marriage is to be a unique relationship. Now, I've sometimes said, and some of you have heard me say this, that the best thing I've ever acquired in life is a wife. But I wouldn't want more than one. Okay. Now that does sound a little bit of a tease, but it's actually true. And the world tells us that having sort of extramarital relationships are normal and actually can enhance your marriage relationship. But the best grounding for a secure relationship is to defend it to the hilt. Now, you may recall that Solomon, King Solomon, had 700 wives and 300 concubines, one of those staggering details in the Bible. Now, aside from having to remember an average of 3 anniversaries a day, I think it teaches us that if one woman isn't enough for you, 1,000 won't be. Okay, if one isn't enough, 1,000 won't be. There's something there, isn't there, in that idea. Once you water down the commitment at all, you'll never really be fully satisfied. And you might want to delve deeper. The Bible describes marriage as a covenant relationship. That might remind you of something. It's something worth exploring and understanding better. Now, to conclude this opening theme, I wanted to major on this one. There was a commentator called Bradley, that was his surname. He wrote in the 1800s, "The noble law of purity lifts man above the brute. The noble law of purity lifts man above the brute." Now, brute is a bit of an old-fashioned word, but it means someone almost animal-like, inhuman, no sort of standards. I think if we wanted to translate that into modern words, I think what it's really saying is that purity is what gives a man or woman dignity. Purity is what gives a man or woman dignity. Now, some of you, like me, might remember the comedian Bobby Ball, brilliant comedian. He became a Christian sort of about middle-aged, and he freely gave his testimony up and down the country in many churches, and you can watch them on YouTube, and they're really worth looking at. Now, he describes his main sort of testimony is that he was a serial adulterer. And by serial adultery, he would say if he was away touring for a week, every night there would be at least one occasion of adultery. So this is serious, serial adultery, okay? Now, he says that when he became a Christian, he was instantly freed of that. The desire, the need, and so on, instantly freed of that. But the bit that strikes me about his story isn't quite so much that. It's what he says. He said the bit that he found especially good, the great thing about becoming a Christian, being freed of that, is he just felt clean. just felt clean inside. Isn't that a wonderful thing? And if we fill our minds and our eyes with the wrong sorts of things, it robs us of that sense. It robs us of courage. It makes us feel dirty and ashamed. It's like having a darkness in our life. So that sense of being clean. Spurgeon said the heaviest thing a man carries around is his conscience, isn't it? So to be free of that heavy conscience. And I believe that how I use my eyes really defines my life. Now, somebody asked me recently what difference I thought the love of God made to me. And the answer I gave him was this. I said I felt that the love of God was about the Lord restoring his image in me. It was about just having an opportunity to rediscover what it means to be the person that God designed me to be. And so how I use my eyes is one of the biggest impacts on that process. It can make all the difference between knowing God's image and God's love in my life or otherwise. Now, I wanted to major on that opening theme, and I'm going to move more quickly through the rest in Job's life, but hope that was helpful. Then what we'll do is we're going to look at how do we cultivate purity in our own lives? What steps can we take to live God's way of holiness? So we'll look at a few more themes, and then how can we respond? So verses 13 to 15, and I will read these again. It says, if I have denied justice to any of my servants, whether male or female, when they had a grievance against me, what will I do when God confronts me? What will I answer when called to account? Did not the one who made me in the womb make them? Did not the same one form us both within our mothers? And I suggest another great measure of the goodness in a person is how they treat those that might be regarded as inferior to them, not how they treat their peers or those superior. Now, in Job's day, it was pretty usual that servants and slaves were regarded as almost sort of subhuman. But Job sees it very differently. Says verse again, did not he who made me in the womb make them? Did not the same one form us both within our mothers? I think I've got this one as a slide, yeah. And this reminds me of something that's reflected in Ephesians. It says, masters, treat your slaves in the same way. Do not threaten them, since you know that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no favoritism with him. How easily are we conditioned by our culture, which speaks about a hierarchy, of some being more important than others? Do we view all people as being made by God and in his image? Even the lowest person we might think of, they're made in God's image. How does that affect how we see people and the way we treat them with dignity and respect, whoever they are? And this is something that is very pleasing to God. Now, the next theme is social justice. This is the verses 16 to 23. And this is where it's speaking about caring for widows and orphans, clothing the poor. And verse 21, this one where it says, if I have raised my hand against the fatherless, knowing that I had influence in court, I think it's really speaking about the powerful using their power to downtread, you know, the weak. Now, don't we see that in our society? But Job says he wouldn't do that. And this reminds me of this social justice of James. Suppose a brother or sister is without clothes and daily food. If one of you says to him, go in peace, keep warm and well fed, but does nothing about their physical needs, what good is it? In the same way, faith by itself, if it is not accompanied by action, is dead. So authentic faith is expressed in deeds. And I think a living church and a loving church is like salt and light in society. And as a church, we need to figure out, what are the needs in our locality? What part can we play individually and corporately? A food bank is a great avenue for this, a great way that that type of care really does please God. And the last theme is also mirrored in the Sermon on the Mount, and that's the love of money and idolatry. Now, it's right and good to be thankful, you know, for our physical provision and for the things that you know, really benefit us. And I think it's also great when looking at nature, because it speaks about worshipping the sun here, that it draws us to consider the work of our Creator. But when either of those things are misplaced, about money or worshipping the stars or creation, those things are unfaithfulness to God. Now, I think a nice summary here is Jesus told a parable which addresses both those last two themes, the theme of social justice and the love of money. And it's The Rich Man and Lazarus. In summary, a man was living in luxury. He refused to give anything to a hungry beggar right at his feet. And it's a very chilling passage to read. It goes on to describe something of the torment of hell, of how that man was judged. Now, Jesus told that to the Pharisees, who believed that wealth was a sign of God's blessing and that poverty was a sign of his judgment. So maybe we're never tempted to think that's true, never tempted to believe that sort of prosperity gospel that's sometimes touted. And I think our attitude towards possessions and wealth is another indicator of whether we're living a very self-centered life or whether we're living under God's lordship. So something to get in its right place. So we've seen something of Job's life and where those different areas of this life make up his character, an example of pure living. But what was it that drove him to live this way? What was it that motivated him to live and strive to live a pure and holy life? Well, I think there's clues right through the text. So don't worry, I'm not going to start the whole thing again, but we'll find out. But it's, in summary, it's about him having an understanding of who God is. Okay, it's more about that. It's not so much him trying to do something. It's response to him understanding who God is. And if we look back, very quick skim of what was there, when on the matter of lust and purity and this idolatry, verse 2 says, "What is our lot from God above, our heritage from the Almighty on high? Is it not ruin for the wicked, disaster for those who do wrong?" In other words, he feared the Lord. He recognized that the consequence of wickedness, of sin, was ruin and disaster under God. And then verse 4, "Does he not see my ways, count my every step?" He knew that God could see his every step. Now for us, if we believe that God in heaven, the holy God, sees our every step, every time we even use our eyes in a wrong way, would we be happy with our behavior? Or would we be maybe ashamed? Now, believing that God really can see us can really affect the way that we think. So Job recognized the holiness of God and that God could see him. On the theme of treating his servants fairly, we saw there he had a conviction that the Lord had the right to call his life to account. Verse 14, "What will I do when God confronts me? What will I answer when called to account?" That reminds me of another parable, the parable of the unmerciful servant. This is one Jesus told, where it says that a man who had a huge debt was forgiven that debt, but then he went and throttled and threw someone in jail that owed him a much lesser number. He was totally unmerciful, and God calls that man to account. And on this subject of wealth and idolatry, verse 28 and 29, "These would also be sins to be judged. I would have been unfaithful to God in high." So he's driven by this respect towards who God is, recognizes the holy God, the one who judges wrong and sin, the one who, and he had no, he felt it was important to be faithful to him. But I wanted to focus on one more response. Maybe they sound fairly negative. God's really severe. He's judgmental. He hates sin. But look at this last one, and I wanted to draw your attention to this. In verse 23, it says, I would have dreaded destruction from God, and for fear of his splendor, I could not do such things. So in a sense, it's not just the sort of fear of judgment that made Job make sure that he was living rightly, but there was some sort of sense of awareness of the very splendor of God. If we can get a glimpse of the beauty and the majesty and the splendor of God, wouldn't we want to shun all evil? Just like it says of Job, he shunned evil. We get that beauty. Psalm 96:9 says that speaks of the splendor of his holiness. I think there's nothing more beautiful than the splendor of the holiness of God. If we can catch a glimpse of that, then how wouldn't that give us that desire to strive to live a life that's free from wrong? Now, the last thing I think to say is that what we're saying there is it's more about his recognizing and understanding something of who God is, rather than trying to well up in myself this self-control and the things I said earlier, like sort of trying not to give in to temptation. It was more about focusing God. So anything we can do to understand who God is more, that's reading his word, gathering together like this, worship, anything we can do to help us get a clearer connection, a relationship with God, that will help us to strive to a holy life. But I think the last two illustrations I want to give you is, the first thing to say is that holiness isn't something that can be attained by our own human effort. It's gained by a humble obedience. Another parable, and I know I quote this every time I ever get up here, but it's the one about the tax collector and the Pharisee going to pray. The Pharisee lifts up his hands and says, "I thank God I'm not like this miserable tax collector." The tax collector wouldn't even lift his head to heaven and said, "Lord, forgive me, a sinner." So it's a humble obedience, and it says that's the one that went home righteous in God's eyes. So it's a humble, it's not trying to do it, it's just submitting, recognizing who God is. And an illustration I heard very recently, which I think is very helpful, is imagine two clay jars, but both of them are very brittle and cracked. One has got a really lovely varnish on it, which covers up all those cracks and you can't see it and it looks beautiful. The other one is untreated and it looks like it's about to fall apart. If you put a candle on each one, the light will shine through the little cracks in the one that doesn't look like very much. And we might feel that we're sort of broken and failed and about to crumble. But the question is, do we want God's light in our life? And if you do, it will shine through, even those things. The Bible says that God's grace is made perfect in our weakness. So I think firstly, it's humble submission. And secondly, do we want the life of God, the light of God in our lives?